Hello, everybody. Welcome to our masterclass today on October 6th, 2022. We have a nice group that's going to present tonight. Seven, because we had to all squeeze them in before they left the internship. They're all supposed to be leaving on the 11th. So we will have some on the 13th as well. They're coming back to go ahead and present. But we did have to squeeze everybody in, as many as we can. So I did put the agenda into the, the chat for this room. We have Yavor Kuzov, Ann Feller, Derek Duker, Aaron Prothero, Sean Perry, Carrie Lewis, and Benjamin Ogugwa. Thank you. Let me get that right. And I think we're ready to start. Is everybody ready to start?
I'm good.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so let's start with, let's make sure everybody's here. I want to see. Go ahead and start as we have it in line. Yavor?
All right, so I guess I'll start. Do I start sharing screens?
Yep, share your screen.
You.
And everybody should have something to present, so that's going to be beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, everybody can see it clearly?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, guys, so as stated, my name is Yavor Kuzov. Today I'll be doing my class on threat actors, their different types, classification and motivations behind their behavior. All right. Okay, why it's not going down? Okay, there we go. We'll be covering the different types of threat actors and that you could encounter. Now, these are in accordance with the standards set by CompTIA for their Security Plus certification. And FYI, there's going to be some pop culture references in here. So, in the words of Black Eyed Peas, let's get started. All right. Starting off, we're going to go over the different types here. Oops, sorry about that. At the very top, we have script kiddies. We have insider threats, corporate competitors, hacktivists. There's criminal organization, state actors, and advanced persistent threats. All right, those are the ones that are defined as currently by CompTIA. All right, and we're going to start off with the first one, which is our script kiddies. Now, script kiddies are, it's kind of like a derogatory term for basically complete novices in the world of hacking or cybersecurity. Basically, the reason they're called script kiddies is because they lack any kind of real experience or any kind of technical knowledge when it comes to the actual methods to hacking and things of that nature. More often than not, what they will do is they will find popular tools like Nmap, Wireshark, I just realized I'm naming the ones that I only know how to use. So that's kind of a blow to my ego right now. But they'll use pre-written scripts when they attempt to launch these attacks. So basically, the way they function is, yeah, I'm going to pull up something like Metasploit framework. I'll try to attack a device. I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't know what's happening. And either it works and it doesn't. So let's say I go to one machine. I try to send an exploit. Didn't work. Then I'm going to go to the second one. That didn't work. Go to the third one. Okay, worked. I'm a hacker. Look at me. I'm awesome. That's basically the way that a script kiddie can be defined by their skill levels. All right. Usually what they'll do is they will attack at absolute random targets. Usually there'll be something really weak or has like very small, very, like I said, weak or no real protection at all. Maybe like your high school server or like a public library, maybe like a low-end type of website, things, places where there's literally no real depth, security in depth where they'll need to maneuver their skills. The type of attacks they launch are rarely malicious in nature. Mostly the real reason the script kiddie will do this stuff is mostly just for like street creds or just to kind of impress their friends and family. Like, look at me, I hacked into this website. I did some stuff with the HTML script. Look at me, I'm awesome. Now, While script kiddies are not considered the most sophisticated, or actually they're the least sophisticated of all types of malicious threat actors, we all start somewhere. So even the best hacker at some point started as a script kiddie, right? I mean, at one point we were all script kiddies. Some of them, myself included, might still be considered that, all right? The thing about a script kiddie is the more they do it, the more confident they become, the more technical knowledge they acquire, and over time they can become more dangerous and become more malicious in nature, right? That's pretty much the biggest, those are the kind of main factors about script kiddies. Next, we have one of the most popular ones, which would be the insider threats. Now, an insider threat is anyone who's either works or has worked for the organization, and therefore they have intimate knowledge of any potential vulnerabilities within that particular organization. All right. This threat could come in multiple forms. Maybe they know that you only set your password once and you never change it again. Or maybe they know that our Wi-Fi password is password. Or they know that the admin credential, username and password is admin. You know, there's different motivations for insider threats. It could be anything ranging between espionage, just sabotage. It might be just a disgruntled employee. Also, insider threat doesn't always have to be malicious in nature. Actually, it could be an insider threat could be literally anybody, because you could just be at your bring your business laptop to a coffee shop. You decide to go to the bathroom. You're logged into your accounts. You don't lock your laptop, and now your information is out in the open for everybody to see. That's a pretty terrible OPSEC, but it does happen. It could be somebody that just decides to, they get a weird email with a link. They weren't paying attention to their, you know, phishing attack seminars, so they decide to click on the link because it says click here to verify your password. All right. So anybody could be an insider threat. It doesn't matter if you're a day one employee or you could be the CEO. So there's really no in between. Those are, let's see here. Like I said, while there may be fundamental differences between a disgruntled employee who is looking for some payback for some perceived wrongdoing, or a careless employee who's left their workstation attended, intent doesn't really mean as much as the actual effect. So it could be literally any one of us. And here's a little fun fact for everybody. Roughly 60% of all reported data breaches are caused by insider threat. So this means that statistically speaking, over half of us could become card-carrying members of this group at some point in our careers. So just something to poof the thought there. All right. Next. We have corporate competitors, right? Companies been using hackers as a way to steal vulnerable information from each other for decades. One of the most notable and infamous instigators of this happens to come from Chinese companies. Over the last 20 years, there's been numerous cases where certain Chinese companies will hack US-based companies or European companies to steal some kind of valuable information about a certain product or certain mechanism, part of an industry. The motivation there is, if I steal your information, that gives me one up and leg up on you in the competition, puts you out of business, more money for me. You're out of business and cornering the market, monopolies basically. Corporate competitors, they're not as likely to happen for, you know, those aren't really something that most likely would occur for somebody. Let's say you work in a small mom and pop office where you're dealing with, you know, you have five employees and you're, you know, baking cookies or something. But on a larger scale, when there's large conglomerates or, you know, Fortune 500 companies, if you happen to work in one of those types, that is a very likely type of threat that you should be on the lookout for. All right. Next, we have one of the other more popular ones called hacktivism. Now, by definition, hacktivism is a social or political activist act that is carried out by breaking into and wreaking havoc on a secure computer system, Hacktivism is a mix of hacking and activism, and is said to have been coined by the hacktivist group Cult of the Dead Cow. This was a pretty famous one of the, actually, I believe it's actually one of the first, if not the first, hacktivist group out there. One of the more notable ones are ones like Anonymous, right? If you noticed, a couple years ago when the murder of George Floyd happened in Minneapolis, they're the ones who actually end up hacking into the police records, end up flooding the internet with that private information. Also, more recently, during the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Anonymous did launch attacks against Russian Interior Ministry offices, where they leaked hundreds of thousands of files of what was considered confidential information. More often than not, hacktivists, they do it out of a sense of belief. It's not so much for financial gain or for bragging rights. These guys are at their soul, they're doing it because from some sense of belief that they're basically doing the right thing. They're exposing the corruption, the lies, that type of that is their main motivation. So it's not something as if you can be bought or bribed or anything that's going to be has any kind of monetary value. Mostly it's based on idealism. Now, hacktivists could be, like I said, for social justice. It could be something along the lines of for political purposes as well. Maybe they feel that some political party is being corrupt, or they're being untruthful. So they may, as a way to expose them, start launching attacks where they will perform DDoSes on their, maybe like a distributed denial of service attack on like a website that's meant to collect funds for their political campaigning. It could be just something as simple as just hacking into the website and then changing some of the fonts to spell out a message or anything of that nature. But as I said, their main reason for it is to just spread awareness and sort of spread a message. Whether that message is considered right or wrong, that's sort of open to interpretation. All right. Next, this one's actually a little more not as common because it's sort of kind of behind the scenes, but over the last 15, 20 years, things like criminal syndicates have really started to move their businesses to the online world. So basically what happens is, you know, once upon a time, people could go down the street, buy drugs from a drug den or something like that. Still possibility, but over the last, I think back in 2012, 2013, there were certain places like the Silk Road, and then its predecessor, Alphabay. These were online marketplaces where you could purchase virtually anything from fake IDs to a whole new identity, weapons, drugs, people. So that was a lot of the times now these criminal organizations are starting to see the value of using online anonymity as a way to make profits. So there are a lot of... These guys are, for the main purpose, is just to make money. So there are groups in certain countries where the organized crime will launch things like DDoS attacks or ransomware attacks against certain organizations as a way to blackmail them, to paying them to release information. Actually, in the United States, one of the most popular places for attacks as far as ransomwares go happen to be things like hospitals, where a criminal organization, a group of criminals will be like, hey, listen, we're going to lock up all these critical information that keeps your employee, your patients from dying. And if you don't pay us within a certain amount of time, we're going to release this. We're not going to release this data and your patients are going to die. Or worse, they'll hack into personnel files or info that has things like PHI or personal health information. And they'll tell us, if you don't pay us, we're gonna sell this information on the dark web. Essentially, they're pretty much being held hostage as a way to spread fear and also as a way to gain money. As a matter of fact, these types of attacks are so common within the United States medical field that a lot of hospitals will actually take ransomware attacks. The payoff, they will budget that into the yearly budget. So just to give you an idea of how often that actually happens. And yeah, so a lot of times now these criminal source organizations are trading hit squads for geek squads. So that's pretty much as far as criminal syndicates go. Next, these ones are nation-state actors. Nation-state actors are pretty much government-funded hacking groups or organizations or departments within the government that their primary purpose is to wage cyber warfare against other nations, right? The most common tactics, techniques, and procedures, or TTP, consist of attacks like direct compromise of financial institutions, attacks carried out against companies that deal with agriculture or natural resources. Actually, when back in February of this year, if some of you recall, before the invasion of Ukraine happened, the Russians actually, they launched massive attacks, cyber attacks against certain parts of the Ukrainian infrastructure, meaning they attacked banks to freeze accounts. They couldn't pay their soldiers. They were shutting down power plants that were producing energy as a way to starve out, as a way to destabilize the interior of the government, as it makes it more easily for them to kind of roll in and take over, theoretically, because it's not working so well for them right now. But in theory, that's the main purpose of nation state actors. Actually, one of the most famous and or most popular types of nation state attacks happened to Iran in 2008. That was the Stuxnet attack, where basically unknown nation state actors that were definitely not Israel and the United States created a malicious worm that was used as a way to infiltrate their Iranian nuclear research facilities. And it was a specific worm that was designed to attack a specific part called a centrifuge that was used to mix something. It was a vital component of the for the procedure, for the production of the for the energy that was used for the nuclear research. And over a period of time, this worm was designated to target this one specific part of the entire infrastructure, secretly destroy it to make it appear that it was a malfunction on its own, and then disappear. Matter of fact, Stuxnet has actually been, it was reported that it has infected virtually all, at this point at least, has infected virtually all devices on a global scale. But the reason, because most of us or none of us have had any kind of issues or has gone undetected, is because the worm, by definition, the worm multiplies itself until it finds a direct target. And then once the target is reached, it destroys it, and then it ceases to exist. So let's say device one has it, goes to device two, that one doesn't have it, device three doesn't have it, device four has it, hits that one, destroys it, moves on like it was never there. You wouldn't even know that it happened until it was already there. So nation state actors, they're one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous, for the simple fact that these guys come with a lot of funding. They have a lot of backing because over the years, more and more focus has been put on cybersecurity, cyber warfare. If you guys have noticed over the last couple months, especially with, again, back with the Russia, war in Russia, there's been a lot more warnings on news and stuff like that about potential threats and viruses being sent over to the U.S. By the Russian government as a way to destabilize our own infrastructure. So, but mainly speaking, nation state actors, those are the guys that are, their main purpose is to carry out the orders of their beneficiaries, which 99 times out of 100, those are going to be the government in which country they reside in. All right. We have something called advanced persistent threats. Now, advanced persistent threat, that's more of a term designed to encompass more of a behavior rather than an individual, but however, that's still something worth mentioning. Generally, when we're speaking of advanced persistent threats, it is a broad term that's used to explain a type of cyber attack campaign where it's meant to be a long-term attack. So if you guys recall, in earlier this year, or even last year too, there was these two major attacks. One happened to be on a meat distribution plant, and the other one was an oil pipe rank. These which were considered an advanced persistent threat. This was something that was constructed over a long period of time where the hackers went inside, they created a backdoor, and over the next couple of months, what they did was they gathered information, they waited for the right time where the attack would be most effective, and waited once that all the parameters were met to do the most damage on the network, that is when the attackers decided to strike and make their play. All right. This is why one of the most common purposes of these are going to be things like rat trojans, basically remote access trojans. Maybe things like adding a logic bomb. So once their campaign on that organization or that particular environment is done, they can destroy all the evidence as they leave out the dorm. These are well coordinated, these are well planned, and these are very well funded attacks. And usually, there will be times where hacktivists or corporate competitors may put in that kind of effort into these type of attacks. But usually, more often than not, this is sort of the trademark of the nation state actors. All right. And that's basically the end of the presentation. Any questions, concerns? Now's the time.
This was excellent. And I love the old computer with the dot matrix printer in that picture. That was hilarious. This was great. Did a good job.
Thank you.
Yvor, were you the one that actually posted on the CyberWiki about having a couple of APTs that were on there?
No, that wasn't me.
Okay, I remember somebody did that. There was a couple of the APTs by grouping on the CyberWiki as well. So if anybody wants to look at those, it's a little extra. It's actually some really interesting read on there.
Any questions? Anything?
Okay, well, if you missed the questions for this point, we'll have questions at the end also, just in case, if you think about it. Awesome. Next one up is Ann Feller. It's all yours.
Yes, that's going to be fun to follow. Make sure I have the right screen going up here. So I am going to be talking about my time at the internship. Didn't mean to click ahead on that yet. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to talk about, but I saw no one else had really discussed how they felt about going through the internship yet. So I thought that would be kind of interesting to discuss, especially since it's a virtual internship, which is pretty unique. I started back in early August, didn't really know what I was getting into. Had a lot going on right when I started, because I pretty much right at the same time started my job as a LAN admin at a mental health hospital for the criminally insane. So there was a lot of stuff going on kind of right at the same time. The position that I'm working now has me kind of going all over the place with IT and working and on all sorts of different systems, both kind of tech support as well as system administration and security and just kind of all of it. So I was interested to see what I could find in the internship to bring to my job as well. As I was signing up for stuff, I was seeing a lot of different places that I'd never really heard of before or really worked with, including TryHackMe and Hack the Box. I'd heard of them, but I'd never even taken the time to look at them. I also knew I wasn't completely alone when I was confused and a little overwhelmed, because it seemed like everybody was, but we all started to get our flow pretty quickly within the first couple of weeks. I started really messing with TryHackMe first with the intro to cybersecurity path. And it was kind of interesting seeing how this was set up and how the attack box worked, how the Kali box worked, and how that let you kind of interact with the stuff that you were going through and how the flags were hidden everywhere and whatnot. It didn't take too long to get the hang of it. That you go through so many different rooms and stuff that you start to get the feel of it pretty quickly. The intro to cybersecurity provided a lot of interesting information, a lot of good overview stuff that I've already kind of talked about at my job a little bit. It was 8 different rooms to go through that talked about different things such as offensive security, defensive security, network security, so on and so forth. It was a good way to kind of get my feet wet and see how this internship was going to go, see what kind of stuff I was going to start learning. The main path I worked on, which took about 8 weeks for me to get all the way through, was the complete beginner path, which was 34 rooms across 8 different segments, and there was a lot to go through. And I actually just finished it up this previous Sunday. For the most part, that was what I focused on, but I also... I'm sorry, my notes are getting me a little confused here, because it shows the next slide, so it threw me off a little bit. Working through the complete beginner path, I got to see a lot of the tools that I heard about in my classes, such as Metasploit, John the Ripper, different types of shells, like the reverse shells and whatnot. I was aware of them previously, but I never really got to tinker with them. And being in the TryHackMe rooms, I really got to sit and play with them a lot more than just simply looking at videos talking about them or doing step-by-step guides. I got to actually mess with them more. Another thing I got to deep dive into working with all of these was Linux, which I'd never really played with. Never really got a chance to in any jobs I worked, since this is my first real IT job anyway. And I'd never just taken the time to mess with it on my own. So I was really interested to start messing with it, especially because I just kind of enjoy doing the coding side of stuff more. And since it doesn't always have a GUI and you're not necessarily forced to use a GUI, it was interesting to learn how to use it. Because of my interest in messing with Linux, I took advantage of the dollar sale from TCM Security for their Linux 101 course. And that also provided a lot of interesting information about Linux. It had a good breakdown of how it works, how the file system works. It went into more detail on the basic commands and how they work. I actually have about a third of this course to go, as the screenshot shows. And that is how I intend on finishing out my internship, plus a little bit more exploring and kind of diving into getting my certifications going. The little bit of this that I did in the middle of the complete beginner path also provided kind of a nice break from the complete beginner path, because that was just so much information kind of being thrown at you pretty quickly, to be honest. Since I started messing with Linux a little bit more, I took advantage of having VirtualBox installed and installed 2 different Linux virtual machines. I did Kali originally as something to work alongside the TCM Linux 101 course, since it's mostly videos. But as I started getting into that, I realized he used Linux Mint instead. And so I could actually follow along. I went ahead and installed a Linux Mint box as well. But even if I'm just using it for this course for right now, they'll both play as resources for me to use in the future if I need to, especially the Cali box, in case I start digging more into like red teaming stuff and getting my hands on that a little bit more. Along with getting to work with some really interesting systems and tools, I also got to interact with a lot of really cool people that had a lot of really interesting experiences to share, both in the cybersecurity department and in the company as a whole. There's a lot of people with different classes that they've been in, different jobs they've been in, just different experiences that they had, and got to have a lot of that shared over the course of the last few or 10 weeks. Meetings were always really interesting because you got to hear stories about what people were working on, what research they've been doing, what software they're developing over their 10 or 12 weeks they're here. So it was always really interesting to see what people were working on outside of just the simple stuff that I felt like I was doing. Not to mention the great lessons that were presented in the Docs Corners every week and just how insightful those always seemed to be. And actually, honestly, kind of miss those a little bit just because they're really interesting. There's a lot to take in over the course of my internship. There's a lot of stuff I'm going to try and integrate into my job, see if I can kind of bring a little emphasis toward kind of internal security and stuff, especially since we're dealing with like patient accounts and a lot of HIPAA information that we'll have to deal with. And I can definitely say I am really grateful for having this experience and getting to actually work with some of the systems that I've gone through rather than just doing research and writing papers like I have in my last 3 years of classes that I've been taking. And I just wanted to say thank you for the great opportunity. And that's it. That's all I got to say. I know it was a little bit shorter, but I also know we had a bunch of presentations tonight, so.
We're not supposed to get emotional while we're in master class, okay?
It's fantastic.
I'm not crying, you're crying.
Right.
Now we're both crying a little bit.
Okay. No, that was great. Thank you so much. We love hearing from everybody, so perfect.
Thank you.
Glad you got something out of it and glad something that you can take to work, because that just makes your job better and makes it seem, you know, it's they're going to keep you longer because you made some changes. So that's always a good one.
Yeah, they might not have much of a red team, but knowing what red team does can help also build the blue team side of it.
Exactly.
So definitely a lot of stuff to kind of go, hey, maybe we tweak this a little bit.
Right. Take it with you. There you go. Thank you so much. So next up, we will do Derek Duker. Am I saying that correctly, Derek?
You are, yeah. It is it was spelled incorrectly, but it pronounced that way. So that's all right.
Oh yeah, I did CK. All right. Okay.
No worries. Okay, let's go. Can you guys see that? Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. So as you can see, tonight I'm gonna be talking about digital forensics. And particularly one tool that I've used throughout my courses here that I really enjoyed using, which is something that we can use to perform digital forensics. So let's just go ahead and jump right in. What is digital forensics? Digital forensics is a branch of forensic science that focuses on the recovery and investigation of material found in digital devices related to cybercrime. There are several steps to digital forensics that take place, and because the data that is getting that is being obtained could be used as evidence in a lawsuit, there are a lot of rules and legal steps that have to be followed when performing a digital investigation, and we'll briefly go over those. So as I mentioned earlier, there are a bunch of steps. There are five steps to digital investigation. Number one is identification, which is identifying why we're doing the investigation, what we need to search through, and what we're looking for. We'll move on to step two, which is collection. As you could probably guess, this is when we actually collect the data. In this step, and I cannot stress enough how important it is to not make any mistakes when collecting this data, because the smallest error or mistake can render the data useless, and the investigation pretty much over at that point. Step three is analysis, where we take the data that we collected in step two, look through it for whatever we identified in step one. Step four is documentation, and that's where we record all of our findings. And this step, it's really useful. Documentation is really useful in this step because it can actually help us sort of recreate the digital crime scene in quotation marks. And then the last step is presentation, where we take all of the information that we documented, that we collected, that we analyzed, and put it into a presentation where we give our findings. So out of those five steps, the two that we think about most often are collection and analysis, because those are really the two most exciting ones. Gathering information or data collection, as I mentioned before, is a very delicate process. If any data is accidentally altered or improperly handled, then that data may not be admissible as evidence in the investigation. Because of this, there are certain precautions that we have to take when gathering data to make sure that the data integrity is secure. One of those would be a chain of custody, which provides a clear timeline of who is in possession of the data at any given time. That way, if something happened to the data, we can easily look back and say, oh, well, this person had it, the data was fine, but when this person had it, it didn't quite line up, so we can know that something else have happened in between those two handoffs, essentially. Another step that we could take to ensure data integrity is through hash checks. And a file hash is just a string of digits that is unique to an individual file based on the content of the file. A file is placed through a hashing algorithm, and it spits out a unique set of codes or a unique set of digits, the length of which is determinant to whichever hashing algorithm you use. There's a bunch of different ones. But the big thing about hashes is that they are unique to that file, because if you change any aspect of the file itself and then put it back through an algorithm, you'll never get the exact same file hash. So it's very unique. So we can keep track of the hash through the different passes. And if we see that, oh, the hash here is this thing, but when we handed it to the next person, it was slightly altered, we know that that is not the exact same file. We know that something has happened to it and we can't use that data anymore. And so because we don't want to mess with the original data at all, but we still need to look through it, the best thing that we can do is to create a data image. And a data image is just a one-to-one copy of a drive. You'll just take the drive and duplicate it. And then now, because we have a copy, we won't have to touch the original one at all. We can manipulate the copy, and the original one will stay just as it was when we took it off of the took it out of the device. Once we have the data copied, we can put that into a program that will allow us to easily search through it. Some of the top three, or the top three most popular ones right now, are EnCase. EnCase is the one that is actually used by law enforcement for their digital forensics. The Forensic Toolkit, FTK, is another really popular one. And then Autopsy is an open sourced forensic investigator. And that's actually the one I'm going to be talking about tonight. So Autopsy, as I said earlier, is a free digital forensics tool that can be downloaded on Windows, Linux, and OS X. It acts as a GUI for the Sleuth Kit, which is a collection of open source utilities for extracting data from disk drives. The Sleuth Kit you can normally do just as like command line, but Autopsy gives you that that graphical representation, which I personally think is really, really nice, because I hate using command line. I'm just so bad at it. But with Autopsy, we can just input a disk image and look right through it. And we are going to do just that. So I have Autopsy pulled up. So this is the first thing that you see whenever you open up Autopsy. You can add a new case, open an old case, or open a recent case. I actually have one that I prepared for this masterclass. So we'll just go ahead and do this Autopsy file right here. And what I'm doing is when I added a new one, it was a .e01 file, which is just an EnCase image file. This is like a sample one that I found online to practice with. So on the left over here, we can see just all the different categories of things we can search through. We can see that there's data sources. If you have multiple ones, they'll show up here and you can search through individual ones. I only have one. This is Charlie Work USB back from 2009. Feels like a lifetime ago. Over here, we have the general information window where you'll see just kind of the overall of whatever you clicked on this side. And then down here in the bottom, whenever you click on something in the general window, it gives you all of the very specific details. Like here's all the hex of this one image, essentially. So a couple things I want to just briefly go over there. You can sort by different file types within Autopsy. So if I want to look at all of the PDF files that show up on this USB, I can do that. I can just see, oh, look, here's all of them. You can see when they were modified, when they were created, the location. You can see all the hashes, like I mentioned earlier, the MD5, the SHA-256. And when we click on one, for example, it'll actually recreate it for us. We can see that this one, this US-504-1044, was a patent document for something. I don't know what he was trying to do with this USB. But it's really cool that it actually like recreates it for you. So you can sort by file types. You can sort by different executables. We see there were two executables on this. We can also sort by, if it's just like an image file, it'll show you all the different like types of image files, and you can click even closer in. So if I want to see all the JPEGs on this file or on this image, excuse me, I can do that, and I can click them, and it, like the PDF, will recreate them here. Really cool. I actually really kind of like this picture. That's a pretty cool picture. Another thing we can do is we can sort by deleted files, which is something that when I first saw Autopsy, I was like, wow, that is incredible that I can do that. This would be really helpful in an investigation because you could see, oh, look, this person tried to delete this this file. That could be possibly destruction of evidence, depending on what the file was and the context of it. But I think it's really cool that you can see like deleted files that they tried to hide. And then under file views, you can also sort by file size. This one, not too great about that, but that is an option. Okay, so the next thing, we can sort by data artifacts. And this one is really cool because you can sort by just different email accounts that have shown up. This file, there are several emails that are like passed back and forth that we can find on here. And we can see, oh, there are four different emails that are passing back and forth. This Jamie and Charlie are the two people. We can even see some of their like emails themselves. So I can see this one. I have something you'll be definitely interested in. It concerns your competitor, ooh, trying to sell out corporate secrets. That's pretty good reason for an investigation to take place. If your competitor just all of a sudden has insider information. So it's good that this person got caught. So other than that, Autopsy, it does very general things. You can search by keywords. You can search by different like expressions. You can search up here in the keyword search to do a substring match. Like if I want to search for all instances of the word Yahoo, because it's 2009 and people still use Yahoo email addresses, we can search and look at that. Every Yahoo email sent back and forth. Want to go see a flick tonight? No, thank you. I'm in masterclass. And then one of the last things I want to talk about with Autopsy is this top bar up here. You can add more data sources if you want to, just like we added this EO1 host. You can look through different images. Like this will just combine all the different images together, and you can search through those. Communication, same thing. It'll bring together all the different emails, email accounts. You can search through those. It'll even visualize it for you, but not here. This one is really cool. Geolocation. If anything on the drive is geotagged, it will show you exactly where that took place. It's unfortunate that nothing on this one was, but it would be cool nonetheless. This one, timeline, is a really big one, I think, for the investigation itself, because when you're trying to document everything, you're trying to recreate the crime scene, having an accurate timeline of everything that has happened on this device will really help that. We can see that the first thing that happened on this drive was in April of 2009, there was a document created. Most of the stuff happened in November and December, but it started as early as April of 2009. And you can see that even more detailed in this timeline. And then finally, one of the most important things is this generate report button. When you generate a report, it does exactly what it sounds like. It generates a report based on everything that you've done. Oh, I just totally realized I forgot to talk about tags. So if you are investigating this, you find something that, oh, this is pretty important, like this astronaut picture, what you can do is you can right-click it, and you can add a file tag. So there are a bunch of different ones. I made important. That one is not a default one. Bookmark, follow-up, notable item, and Project VIC are. So if I were just going through all the data and I needed to, I found something interesting, but I didn't have time right now to look at it, I could just hit follow up. It'll mark it. And then if I go down to tags, I can see, oh, there's one thing in follow up that I need to look at. File tags. Okay. Then I can go back and look at this. You can do that with anything that you find on here. But going back to what I was talking about, this generate report, when you generate a report, you can generate a bunch of different types. HTML is probably the easiest right now. You can check which data source you want. Right here is where the tags come in. You can report on all the results, all the tagged results, or even just specific tagged results. Like if I want to do just the follow-up ones, not these notable items are important, I could do that. For this instance, I'm going to do all results. And it'll generate it. Generates it pretty quickly. To be fair, this is not that big of a file, so that may vary. But then you can click this, it'll open up, and we can see that, hey, this is our autopsy forensic report. It gives me information about the image information. This is where it's located on my computer. More information just about autopsy in general. But when we go over here to the left side on the report navigation screen, we can see this was reporting that, hey, just like I said earlier, there are four email addresses identified in this. There are two different email messages. And if we scroll all the way over, we can see that they even show them in plain text, just the entire email right here, which is really cool. We can see different keyword hits. Just because I did all of the results, it's a whole lot right here, 570 of them. But it's pretty cool. It even shows you the tagged files, even though we hit all files. So yeah, that is just a very incredibly brief overview of autopsy. I think it was really cool when I learned about it. And I think it was IT316. These class numbers all kind of blur together. But I thought it was really cool, and I just wanted to share that with all of you tonight. So if anybody has any questions, I would be more than happy to answer them. But other than that, I think that is it for me tonight. Thanks.
Matthew, do you have a question?
No, sorry, I just raised my hand, lowered it.
You just felt like raising your hand? Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Gotta get great that exercise job, in. Thank you.
That was a really, I've never seen that tool before. That is really interesting. Does anyone have any questions for Derek?
No questions, but I just want to say, man, you did a great job, because like 3 weeks ago, I actually had to use this tool for when because I'm in digital forensics class, is my other class. So in our InfoSec lab, like this was one of our tools we had to use for the lab. And man, it took me like a hot minute to figure out all the tools. I'm kind of salty you didn't do this sooner, but it made my homework assignment a lot easier that day.
Sorry, but man. Good job, man. Thank you. Thank you. This is I'm one of the people graduating on Tuesday. So this is my last opportunity to do this. I probably should have done it earlier, but procrastination and all, it happens.
So is digital forensics something you plan on going into, Derek?
Not at the current moment. I actually just secured a job with just a general IT services company here in Indianapolis. I think digital forensics, since I've learned about it, has always been something that has like interested me, just because it's not something that a whole lot of people think about, especially like in regards to like big data breaches. Like, yeah, we hear about them happening in the news, but like, how did it happen is the kind of stuff that I'm more interested in. Maybe eventually, if I can convince this new company to start doing that, that'd be kind of cool. But as of right now, I'm not planning on doing it. It's just something that I liked learning about, and I just wanted to talk about tonight.
Awesome.
All right. Anybody else have any questions or comments? Okay, we'll keep moving. Aaron, I think you're up next.
I most certainly am. See if we can get this going here. Can everybody see my screen there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Perfect. Yes, we can.
All right. So I am going to do this on Bash scripting. I'm going to go over a little history on Bash itself. There's a couple of things I found interesting, kind of what is Bash, and then go into the actual scripting aspect of it. And then I will, like Derek, kind of have a little hands-on demonstration at the end, kind of write a little, script that you can use, things like that, and go over that. So Bash, anybody doesn't know, the born-again shell. So Bash actually came out in 1989. Great year. I was born that year, by the way. The original was actually supposed to be the Bourne show. But Linus Torvalds found out about Brian Fox working on the Born Again shell and actually decided to use that one as the primary in any Linux distributions and things like that. Also available on Mac and Windows. Windows 10, you can get it as a kind of like a feature you could add in. Mac versions 10.3 all the way up until, I forget the exact version number, but Catalina basically in 2019. It was a default for Mac OS, and it actually went over to ZSH as its primary there. So it's really interesting that you can, you know, one too far, sorry about that. Bash by itself is a command processor. It doesn't actually add any, you know, things to it, but you can use command language to actually go ahead and perform actions, change files, move things. You're actually using the command line to affect the actual computer and OS itself. And then any of these commands, what we're going to talk about here in a second, can be automated through scripting, and they will allow users to perform multiple functions, you know, a lot more easily. So for scripting is the use of commands within an application for the purpose of automating certain features that are already present. When you think about it, if you hear about scripting in gaming, they're not actually creating a game. They're already using what the game offers and just automating it to, you know, cheat the system or whatever. Same thing when you're writing a script. You're not creating any new functionality. Instead, you're actually going through and using what's pre-existing and automating the features to go through that. That's why scripting is kind of the down and dirty form of programming, because you're just using what's there and then you're automating a lot of processes and stuff like that. So getting into actually setting up a Bash script, a couple things that you actually going to have to be able to do are here. So when you're creating the file, you need to make sure it has a .sh extension that labels it as a shell extension, and you can actually use it as a script when you run it and things like that. You do need to make sure that you chmod it, add yourself the executable. And if you need to, I put it there as well. Depending on what user you are, what level of permissions you have on your system, you might need to sudo chmod it, and then type in the password for the actual sudo. But if you got permission, especially, I know Anne said that she was using a Kali version. If you're even on just a basic Kali machine, normally you'll have permission to just chmod plus X, name of the script. And then when you are executing it, you actually do it as a ./ name of the script, and that will actually execute the file. When you're writing the script, the first actually needs to be shebang bin bash. The pound exclamation point is shebang, and that is actually the absolute file path to the bash interpreter, and again instructs the file to be ran as a bash script. If it doesn't see the shebang bin bash, it won't run it as a script. You'll try to run it and it'll just say this isn't a script, or you're just trying to run this and I have no idea what you're trying to run it as, basically. When you're writing it, when you actually get into writing it, all bash commands can be used. So if you have, like I said, cat, ping, nmap, I'm sure you could do Metasploitable in some way, but when you get into individual GUIs, like Metasploitable has its own kind of like interface in there, it might be a little bit more difficult. But any of that. And there is also ways to incorporate, I saw online, so maybe like C# and things like that into bash scripting that you can actually throw in there. That's something I don't have personally experience with, but there are other ways that you can do that as well. And then for writing the script, there are a couple of different things that you can use for the automation. We have our loops and conditionals, and then things like functions, arrays, and other things like that. So loops and conditionals, you're basically using if, else, else if, for, and while to look for certain true statements to execute a certain number of times, basically. So if then, anybody that knows programming, if then, if this is true, then do this. Else if this is true, then do this. Else, and else is kind of the default. So if becomes zero, else if is zero, so they're both negative, it'll automatically default to else if an else statement is there. Otherwise, it just won't run. The for loop is actually used if you have a set number of iterations you want to use. So 4 counting 1 through 10 would iterate 10 times. While will execute indefinitely until a false statement is returned. So if you have a preset number, like I only want this to run 10 times, 100 times, you'd use 4. While would go through the entire list. And if you have a list that's updated, you could have it like it's flowing, it's, you know, dynamic, then you can actually use a while statement to keep it going as long as it's got information flowing in. You also have your arrays, which are lists of numbers set up in a certain, you know, pattern and things like that. So you can use the my array equals in quotes 1, 2, 3, or you can also set arrays. And then the script here I've got here in a second I'll show, you can use array as a like a text file, for instance, and you can set that up as using that as a parameter, and you can use that text file. And it's not required the way I set it up, but I wanted to show some of the functionality we have here. So you can use that text file as kind of being placed into the variable. You also have functions, and then the dollar sign. I wanted to throw this in here as well because I do use it. Dollar sign calls the variable and also is used for arguments. So if you have like a dollar sign one, if you think about ping 192.168.0.1 for an internal thing, that IP address 192.blah blah blah would be argument one for the ping command. So if you did like dollar sign one, it would run that individual argument in place of the variable that you're trying to call it for. And I'll show that here now, actually. And I wanted to do this a little bit quicker just because I did have, and you can all see my Kali box, right? So this is kind of when I have my thing up here on the right hand side and on the left, and I've got a couple of things counted out right here just because I wanted to be able to kind of show what each individual thing does. I did get the primary for this off of a YouTube video off of the Cyber Mentor, actually kind of did it. I critiqued it a little bit, changed it, and then I do have another script here that I add more functionality to, but I wanted to kind of start low, go a little bit higher without going too over the 15 minutes. Do this really quick. So if we can see here, if I were to run, this is actually my example .sh, and I know my internal address is 192.168. I did that wrong because my example 192.168.0. Why am I doing that? I am panicking because I don't want to go too long. I apologize. There we go. New line. It's going to make me look like an idiot, isn't it? Oh, because I didn't. I apologize. Let's not. I had this all set up earlier, and then there we go. It is going to, you know what, I'm not even going to do that then. I'm just going to do my sweeper because that is going to be easier. And I will over here right and quick, and then this was working earlier and now I am wondering why. Did that take me out of scripts? No, it did not. Oh, I did sweep, not sweeper. There we go. Let's not panic too much. So, okay. Back on track. We're good. So we first off have that we are going to ask the user for a network they want to scan on the first three octets. And then I can put 192.168.0. And then because my IP right here that I'm reading, I'm using the read function right here. So it's calling the read function right here. It's not blank. I'm actually inserting something over here. So it's going to skip this and it's going to default to the else statement. And it's going to do a loop where, again, I'm calling the IP right here. And then using the for sequence 1 to 254. So it's going to do 192.168.0.1.2.3, and it's going to loop each of those individually and run through it. And then what I'm doing right here with the grep statement right here, is it's looking for anybody that's on a ping request before will know that anytime you get a confirmation of a ping received, it'll send back the 64 bytes. So we're actually using the grep to pull any lines that have a 64 bytes confirmation. And then using the cut and truncate functions right there to limit down what is actually on that to just the IP addresses. And then we are actually going to save that right here. Once it's done, we are putting that into iplist.txt. We're running that through and using my array function, like I said earlier, using list as a array. And then down here, using a while for however many lines we're going to get and how many actual things we're going to get. Do, and then we're going to nmap the line. And I'm actually using, again, here and here, you'll see the and symbols. Those are actually allowing it to run kind of multiple times at once. So it's not going to do ping one, ping two. It's going to like batch ping a bunch of things at once and run faster than it would if it was just doing it single line by line. And then here we're using the call list, and we're actually putting that into the loop so that while we're reading lines in this particular list, it's going to nmap each of those. So what we're going to see over here is, and because actually I'm going to say this really quick, because I am throwing this into the iplist.txt, it's not going to show the individual pings. It actually starts just running the nmap for all the individual pings that we did. So if we run this, why is this making me? What did I do? I literally ran this earlier. And it was perfect. I am going to feel like the biggest idiot here in a couple of seconds. Please do apologize. I literally tested this before I came in, and it was like, it was perfect. It ran with no issues. It's giving me my please select an IP address and range for IP. It's only if that, else. Do this. Let's see if that's going to change anything. I doubt it, but we're going to see. Actually, I don't think I need to exit one either. I'm not going to have any. Please forgive me. This ran perfectly fine like an hour ago, and now I don't know why it's not. So that was supposed to be a script that I was able to get running, and now I'm going to spend all night trying to figure out why it's not running. Because it was perfectly fine an hour ago, and what did I change? I didn't change anything. Nothing's been... It's not blank. Maybe? I'm going to feel like the biggest idiot if that was literally it. Nope. This is not the hour for doing that, though. Binbash. Using Binbash, please enter the network you wish to scan, read IP. If else for address, count one, do that, grep, and done, iplist.txt, fi. And I could do The stupidest thing in the world. Didn't change anything. Nothing has changed on this, except I'm now in front of 15 people. And literally, that's the only thing I have changed. I'm going to see if I can yield the floor right now and figure out why this is not working, because I'm not going to hold you all off to me running tests and things like that. I do apologize. Again, I have no idea what's going on. It ran perfectly fine an hour before this and was... Yeah, no, it's exactly it. Undefined thing, need to read the input?
Like, Aaron, happens.
I get it. I'm more like, I said, like, if I was like, if I hadn't tested this like an hour before we did this, I would be like, oh, I messed up somewhere. Let me figure out. I literally ran this script before I did this by like 60 minutes and it ran with no issues doing exactly what I did. And now it's. You say, right, but the address variable. Oh, okay. So that's what actually, and you say, Matthew, the address variable is undefined. When you do a for loop, you're actually defining a user variable right here to be used for the sequence. So what you're actually doing is setting a user variable address, and then each time it iterates, that address is going to be 1, then 2, then 3. The thing that's...
Aaron, real quick, have you checked the IP address you're trying to run the script on?
Yeah. It's an internal address. It's an internal IP. And I literally use the exact same IP. Like I said, I had this working an hour before, and it's the exact same thing. No changes, no anything. Done. Okay, so let me go through this. Bin bash, echo, boom, read IP. If IP equals nothing, then... But it's not nothing. I'm not leaving it blank. And that's kind of what's tripping me up, too, is because this part right here is only to say, hey, you didn't really select a network to charge or to scan. So let's, you know, fix that. Otherwise, if you actually input. Let me actually just do this, then. Let me just do S1. I'm going to see if I can bypass that. I'm going to try to bypass it with using an argument statement. And this will go back into running the arguments I was talking about earlier. And I'm going to have to figure that out. But see if I can 192.168.0 and see if that will. Oh, it's going to tell me. Yeah, of course, I have to comment that out. And then just do this. It's the way it's supposed to run. I literally just commented that out. Why are you? Oh, because it's still asking for this. Booking feet. This is why I stopped scripting for a long time, because I was running into things like this. And then you see the answer, and it's like, that was, hey, there we go. The dumbest answer in the world. But yeah, so we threw that into a list, and then we nmap each of the individual things. So now rather than pinging each individual IP address and then nmapping each individual IP address, we now have a list of all open ports on the network. That's how simple it was supposed to be. But for some reason, it didn't want to do that. I apologize. It's probably over the 15 minutes. But yeah, let me just quickly, because I didn't really explain that very well. So minus the if statement being a pain in my butt for whatever reason. I don't know why. It like I said, it literally worked an hour ago. I literally tested it. It was fine. I apologize. What we're doing here is we're using a for statement. You can see right here, like I said before, we were setting the ADDR address as a user-defined variable to run through the sequence of 1 to 254, as that's the most common, you know, IP addresses, and especially in internal networks and things like that. So when you're pinging the entire range, we are using, when you ping, I'm doing -C1. It means only send a single ping request, especially in Linux. If you just ping an IP address, it'll ping indefinitely until you cancel it. So saying bing -C1, it'll only send a single ping request and receive or not receive a confirmation. We're using the grep statement right here. And what we're actually doing is grep is finding a certain combination of words, characters, whatever, within a line and pulling that entire line. So grep by itself doesn't just pull 64 bytes, it pulls the entirety of what that 64 bytes looks like. So if I go ahead and do this really quick, let me go ahead and do ping 192.168.0.1 with a count of 1. We see right here 64 bytes from, and you get all this other information as well. But when we're making, if I actually show you the IP list.txt that it creates, this. So we actually use those grep, cut, and truncate features that are in there to actually cut down that entire line just to the IP addresses. And when we use those IP addresses in the while statement, what we're actually getting is the ability to nmap each individual one automatically, rather than, again, having to go through and do them, you know, over and over again. And Yavor, you have a question or a statement of how bad that and terrible that was.
No, man, you did great. My question is, when you run that particular script for the IP address, can you run more than one IP address at a time with that script, or does it have to be one at a time?
Right now it's one at a time, only because I kind of threw this together as a quick example. You probably could do it as a individual. I don't have it set up as a S1, S2, but again, for small ones like this, the entire thing took 15.32 seconds to run. And then you could just run it again, and you can actually, you know, do it over and over again. I don't have a way at current to do it for multiple IP addresses. I'm sure that there are ways to set it up that way. And this is kind of why I wanted to work with this, is so I could get it even better. Kind of throwing this together within the last week, especially of trying to narrow it down into that, I do want to expand upon that, find out ways to. You can also do nested loops as well. So I'm doing 192.168.0.1.2.3 as a Class C network. Basically being very, you know, you have the three octets that are the network portion, and the last octet is the individual host. If you're going into like Class A, which for IP addresses is like 10.0, and then the .0.0.0.1 are the individual hosts, you could do nested loops with that and do 4.192.168.1, then do the entire sequence 1 to 254.2, then do the entire sequence. You can use a nested loop to actually go through each individual like section by that as well and run it that way. As for running in this currently individual IP addresses in one, what you have to look at is the way it is actually currently reading the individual IP addresses as being the statements and arguments that I'm actually including in that would not be able to currently handle that. I apologize for running like 30 minutes rather than 15. I will yield my time now. And I'm going to tonight probably pick this apart one by one and figure out why it wanted to make me look like a butthead. Thank you.
Great job.
Terrible job, but thank you.
No, but I had the same problem last night when I was teaching my class. I was showing them how to do the lab, and I couldn't get it to work. And that was really frustrating. So it happens to everybody.
I know. It's just like, I have to know why now is the thing.
Yeah, I figured it out and I finished the class out. I was like, see, I told you I could do it. So you'll get there. That was really great. I was, that's a lot of bash that I didn't know. So thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions for Aaron?
Actually, I have like one more question.
Sure.
So Aaron, real quick, as far as if anybody's interested in like learning more about the syntax for Bash or where you found your information, can you like provide like a link asking for
a
friend?
Yeah, no. So the primary head of that script, the initial ping sweep, was actually the full 12-hour course by the Cyber Mentor online. He walks you through how to do that in there, and it actually kind of got me interested in getting back into Bash. And that's kind of, I was going through watching some videos to get back into Bash when I was thinking about I wanted to do Bash versus Python for this, and I realized, oh no, I can only do 15 minutes. Let's just do Bash. That would have been a cluster mess on its own. So I ended up actually going through watching some Bash and Linux scripting and all that stuff, and he showed that first snippet of the four IP in sequence and then how to ping sweep it and cut it down and things like that. And I ended up adding the nmap portion of it as well to make it so it took each individual thing and then nmapped it and how you can use other things. It was kind of primarily just to show how each of these individual, the loops and the other functions can come together to do more.
Got it. Thank you.
No problem.
Awesome. Sean, I think you're up.
All righty then.
I'm sorry?
Trying to get shared my screen here. All right. All right, my name is Sean Perry. I'm going to do the do's and don'ts of time management. Can everybody hear me and see my screen?
We can hear you, but I can't see your screen.
Uh-oh. What I was afraid of. Can we see it now?
No, not yet. Oh. Are you clicking on the arrow up by the leave button?
Yep.
And then clicking the desktop or a specific screen. There, I think it's coming now. There you go.
All right.
You're good.
First time. Get this back to the beginning. All right, my name is Sean Perry. This is Time Management, the do's and don'ts from working from home or doing schoolwork. So how do you use your time? The first thing you must do is determine how much you can do in any given day. You want to be able to know exactly how much you can produce or do in a single day. And then what you're going to do with this is you're going to time yourself out and make a schedule. You want details of your current progress. You need to focus on your activities that provide you a good return, meaning you want to work in comfortable setting. You don't want to stress yourself out or work on too many things at one time. You want to be honest on your review of time that you spend, so you're not cheating yourself thinking you can get more done than you actually can. Otherwise, when you start to schedule this out, you're going to overwhelm yourself and fall far behind. Next, like I said, it's going to prioritize your day. You can write this down. Don't try to tackle too many things at once. You need to split it up into individual tasks and individual goals. Keep it simple. You want to tackle one task at a time. You want to list the tasks either by most important or what's under urgency restraint or time restraint. Prioritize them down. Write them all down and follow them down step by step, possibly making a block chart like you do for risk assessment in order to divide them out and how you need to get them done. Make a daily schedule and then schedule that out for the whole week at a time. But don't go too far beyond that, because then you get too far in the scope and sometimes those goals don't get met. You want to be able to take little chunks at a time, one step at a time, one little bit at a time, and that way your goals are always achievable. You want to start from the top and work your way down. If you hit a stopper during that schedule, go to the next task and then go back to that task that you didn't finish. It might clear up your head if you work on something else and then be able to go back and finish it. A lot of things like that I use in Try Hack Manual work. Hack the box, I switch up where what I'm doing and where I'm working because I get stuck on a certain phase. Or command lines is another good example. Assign time limits to your schedule. When you schedule up a task, they should have a time listed to them. That way you can keep track of how many minutes or hours you're working on a certain project in order to space it out throughout the time. It'll give you a good pace for the day. It'll keep you steady throughout the day. This also allows for our time balancing and to avoid stress. Gives you mental clarity. You're less stressed over the fact that you know you have a certain amount of time and a certain amount of events, and you're already scheduled those out to be done within that certain amount of time. If it's 8 hours or 10 or 5, doesn't matter. Schedule tasks anywhere between 25 to 30 minutes, and then have small breaks in between. Get up, walk around, get a glass of water. Or something that I like to do if I take my dogs out when I'm working from home, give them a bathroom break. Well, I take a break. After you've completed several breaks or several tasks, multiple tasks in a row, then you can go take a longer break, get a snack, or whatever you like to do, play a game on your phone. Buffers are always needed, and that's what the assigned breaks or fours for buffers in order to keep your mind fresh and clear, and then you're not stuck on any problem. You take a break and clear your mind. Eliminate distractions. You want to turn off your TVs and other devices that may distract you from what you're doing. Soft music in the background is usually okay. It can calm you to make you work better, but TV is not a good thing to put up. Most of the time there's action, gunshots, other things going on the TV, or something that's going to pull your eyes and distract you from it. Sometimes it's suggested to keep your phone out of the room or turn it off. If your phone's there with you, then you're tempted to be picking it up, looking at emails or texts that family members are saying. We have a family group chat from my wife's side of the family, and they're always saying something. When I used to work at Indiana Vendor Home in the basement, I'd come up to work on a computer, and as soon as I hit the main floor, I'd get 30 texts all at once, and it was very distracting hearing all that noise. Lock your animals out of your room. I have several dogs and cats, and the pets can be a distraction if they need to go out, or they need to bother you, or they want you to play with them. And then if you're like my cat, he likes to come in and grab my arms and wants me to give him a good petting and loving. And he's got some sharp claws. Another distraction is your significant others, your wife and kids. They can be distractions. That's why it's good to set those time frames, because you can let them know that this is the time that you're going to be working on, whether it's schoolwork or working from home, as I do on Fridays. very important to keep them informed. You need to build those buffers. Develop breaks within your work schedule. Plan on breaks throughout the day. When I'm at the office, I take a break and I go walking around the building on the inside if it's inclement weather outside, or I'll walk the parking lot if it's nice weather outside. It's just a 10 minutes, maybe 5-10 minutes, just to stretch my legs, get myself off of the computer screen. It helps you do more in less time. It's refreshing for your mind, and you become more productive because of it. It helps increase your mental well-being. No breaks means you may burn out quicker. You'll end up with fatigue or a loss of engagement of the work process. And you're less likely to get burned out if you have those buffers built into your workday. Avoid multitasking. Multitasking switches your brain's focus from one area to another. It tends to get you off track, and you lose your extended concentration that is needed for innovative thinking. And this will allow you to think outside the box, come up with new ideas or a different plan to approach a certain problem. It takes time to refocus your brain, and it causes a loss of productivity. On average, a research study was done that 23 minutes to completely refocus from one area to another. And that is a 40% loss of your productive time. Research shows that people who think they are good multitaskers are actually worse at it. These are just different time management tips from Dharma that I picked out. Some of them that are good to know are, it's always good to determine or set up long-term and short-term goals. Build your schedules around these and to meet those goals. Remember, there's always enough time to get things done, especially if they're important. Keep paper and calendar with you in order to jot things down that are important for your notes and dates for yourself in your scheduling. These are just another set of examples. Make reminders for yourself and place them where you can see them. You can put them on a mirror in your bathroom or your desk or on the TV. They remind you of different goals that you need to attain or different focuses you need to remember. Remember, you have to focus one thing at a time until it's finished. Keep it one step at a time. Always ask for advice if you're confused or uncertain about anything you need to do for the next. And always ask other people about their time management tips. This is not an all-inclusive. Everybody's different, and everybody does, just like everybody's learning speed is different and how they learn is different completely. But most of all, you need to concentrate one thing at a time. These are the references I used for this presentation. And are there any questions or comments?
Great job, Sean. I think you're right about the people who think they're good multitaskers are usually the ones that are not.
Yeah.
I agree. The more time I try to do, two things at once, I don't ever get either one of them done.
Yeah, you end up going backwards instead of forwards.
Yeah, exactly. Carrie, I think you are up.
Here I go.
All right.
Don't worry, Kara. You can't do worse than me. You're fine.
Oh, please. You did amazing. Your information was way above my head because I feel like I'm just kind of floating through the IT world on a management level. So I'm not really, I don't know. I don't have all the skills, but I'm trying. So I'm going to go over the history of women in information technology. I'm not a master at it, but that's kind of what drew me into this career. So I graduated high school in 99, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I ended up taking some community college classes, but I realized I didn't want to do conventional school anymore. So I decided to become a hairstylist. And so that's what I did. Fast forward a few decades,
maybe just one and a half. And the Navy moved me and my husband to Japan. So I had to quit working and I started a family. And then we moved back to the States in 2017 and I decided to go back to school. But again, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So my husband had just graduated from Purdue and I looked through the catalog trying to decide what I wanted to do. I wanted something I enjoyed, something I could make some money at, and something that would also be able to travel with us because he's still in the military and we still travel. So I thought about IT and realized how few women were in IT and even fewer that were at a management level in IT. So I love a challenge and decided, yep, this is what I want to do. So IT management is what my degree will be in. I'm not a master of anything other than my own demise. So I wanted to do my presentation on a few women who helped pave the way for me and others to have the opportunity to be in this field. So this is Augusta Ada Byron. She was the daughter of Lord Byron, who was a famous poet. She was taught math and science, which wasn't normal at the time because that was strictly for men. Her mother thought rigorous studies would keep her from being moody like her father, which I found hilarious. One of the first women admitted into the Royal Astronomical Society. At 17, she met her future mentor, mathematician, and inventor, known as the father of the computer, Charles Babbage. she was asked to translate an article on his analytical engine. She translated it from French to English, adding her own thoughts and ideas. Her notes explain how codes could represent symbols, letters, and numbers, resulting in being considered the first computer programmer. She also theorized a method for repeating a series of instructions over and over, which is what we now call looping in computer programming. And in 1980, the Department of Defense named a computer language after her called Ada. This is Grace Hopper. She was an American mathematician and retired Rear Admiral in the Navy. She helped developed UNIVAC 1, which was the first electronic commercial computer and naval applications for COBOL. She taught math at Vassar College before joining the Navy Reserves in 1943. She actually worked on Mark 1, the first auto calculator, where she coined the term a bug to explain an unexplained computer failure because a moth had flown inside of her computer and caused it to stop working. She created an updated compiler that translates programmers' instructions into computer codes. She retired from the Navy in 1966, but recalled the following year to help create a cohesive computer language. She was the oldest active duty officer in the United States Navy when she retired at the age of 79 in 1986. She was named the first computer science man of the year in 1969 and posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2016. This is Jean Bartique. During the World War II, she was recruited by the U.S. Army as a human computer to help calculate ballistics trajectories years before machine computers could even make the calculations. After beginning work for the Army, the Electronic Numeric Integrator and Computer Project was the first programmable electrical general-purpose digital computer completed in 1945 that promised to track trajectories faster than humanly possible. She was one of six women accepted to work on the entire program. She taught herself how to program ENIAC after interviewing the engineers and studying the schematics. And while learning it, she developed several fundamentals for programming, such as subroutines and nesting, which is what most programmers use today. She went on to program one of the earliest commercial computers, UNIVAC, the first general-purpose electrical digital computer. And this is Julia Lewison. She joined Microsoft in 1992 right out of college and began working on Microsoft Access. Her team builds all compiler technologies at Microsoft, including C++, C#, F#, Visual Basic, TypeScript, and all runtimes, just to name a few. She was one of the original developers of Visual Studio and is now the head of, she's a senior VP for Visual Studio, and it's the most popular one run by a woman engineer. She's been described as an inspiration for women in technology for actively promoting women in STEM. These are some other notable ladies in the IT world. It's Annie Easley. She was known for shattering the glass ceilings for women in STEM. She began her career in the 50s as a human computer, much like Jean Bartique. where she did computations for researchers by hand and even developed the code that is still used in energy conversion systems that created batteries for the hybrid vehicles that are on the road today. Hedy Lamarr was an Austrian-American actress in the 30s and 40s and known as a bombshell with brains. They said she was too pretty to be so smart. Not only was she beautiful and an actress, but she also pioneered the technology that laid the base for Wi-Fi, GPS, and Bluetooth communication via communication system for the U.S. Navy to help throw radio-guided torpedoes off their course in 1942. Mary Allen Wilkes is a lawyer and computer programmer who was told in eighth grade by her geography teacher that she should be a programmer just based on how her brain worked. After college, she wanted to be a lawyer, but it was a male-friendly occupation at the time. So recalling her teacher's words, she asked her parents to drive her to MIT to apply for a job. In 1965, she became the first person to ever use a mini computer, which was a Link PC, in her living room. And Adele Goldberg is a computer scientist who helped develop multiple concepts related to OOP, as well as a program language called Smalltalk 80, which she reluctantly showed to Steve Jobs, which then became the basis for the Apple desktop. So with a deep history of such amazing women, why aren't more women in IT now? In 2017, a man who had been working for Google for 4 years, named James Damore, sent an email stating women have higher rates of anxiety than men and couldn't thrive in the coding world, stating that men systemize while women empathize. He was later fired from Google, stating that they couldn't employ anyone with such massive gender bias. In the early 20th century, women were given more man jobs due to all the men going off to war and forcing society to think of women as equal to men. In the 70s, society also began to realize how important technology was starting to be in government and in industry, and decided that men were the only ones who should have these top-level jobs. So the jobs were given new advanced titles that, even though women had been doing them for so long, at lower pay and recognition. And by the 90s, men in technology accounted for over 70% of computer science graduates. But thanks to the internet and women having the ability to reach a multitude of other women in IT, opportunities began to grow. And in 1994, Anita Borg created the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing Conference, which eventually led to the Institute for Women in Technology, which continues to help women with opportunities in IT today. According to labor statistics, 26.7% of workers in computer-related fields globally are female, with 47.7% of the entire workforce being women. The past few years have seen women of all races become more and more interested in technology, but the percentage of women pursuing STEM subjects in higher education is still on the decline, and women achieve just 18% of new computer science degrees. There's clearly still a long way to go to reach gender equality in the tech industry, but if the long history of women's consistent, persisting, and pioneering involvement in the industry is anything to go by, the 21st century has the power and potential to go down in history as the decade that truly tackled the gender gap in tech. And these are some of the groups that promote women and helping them with IT. The Women in Technology is one of the main ones that I've actually been a part of. It's located in DC, but has chapters everywhere. ACM. Actually, I am a part of the chapter with Purdue, but there's also one specifically catered to women that I don't think that we have it here, but there are chapters. There's Mother Coders, which is for women who have children who are also trying to get back out into the workforce, which I really feel like I felt that just because I was in the same position. There's also Girls Who Code, which my daughter has been a part of. And AnitaB.org and Girls in Tech. So there's a lot of options out there for women to get started in. And that's all I have.
Bravo.
Wow, Carrie, that was really great.
That was, yeah, you were worried. That was very informative and very good.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Does anyone have any questions for Carrie? Really great.
Thank you.
Okay. Last but not least, Benjamin, I think you are up.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello, we can hear you.
If you're talking, we can't hear you.
Heard him for a second.
Yeah, I heard him say hi. We can't hear you now, Benjamin, if you're talking.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
A little, it's light, but we can hear you.
Today's presentation, the use of this.
Benjamin, we can barely hear you.
Can you hear me okay?
I don't know. Is that any better for anybody else?
Oh, can you hear me okay?
No.
You sound like you're a little bit farther from the mic. You sound like a background more than.
Yeah.
Like, can you get.
Can you hear me?
That's better.
That's okay. Better.
Maybe I have to be very close to my.
Yeah, it's. I don't know if you have any like dampers on your microphone or anything like that, but you just sound like you were like across the room talking.
Okay. For the purpose of this presentation today, I will be presenting on how to create organizational unit user accounts in Active Directory on Windows. Server 2019 Active Directory. But due to the time, I will be going to work so pretty late. I will skip something. Please permit me to do some things before my demo. But on the screen here, as you can see, this is what I'm about to do in my presentation, trying to create organizational unit user account and groups in Windows Server 2019 AD. So let me just pop up this. So in this demonstration, I have already configured the Windows Server 2019 Active Directory in this machine. Let's hold on a little bit. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine now.
Yep.
So here, I start from here. Ready to install some here. Here is my local server, which you can see here that my computer name is WS2K19DC01, and my domain is mylab.bang. So other things has been configured in this server. to start creating a organizational unit in this server. We have to go to the tools and go to Active Directory user on computer. Yeah, my machine is just a kind of little slow, you know. Just bear with me. Okay. So in this panel, there are certain containers that are here. You can configure the Active Directories or can make use of. So but for the purpose of this demonstration, I am going to create the organizational unit in mylab.bang. So let's go ahead. Go to new, click on new. So in this panel, you can also use this object to create groups, organizational units, users in this object. So for this presentation, I am going to use organizational unit. Here, as you can see at the object here, the organizational unit, it says create in mylab.bang. So for me to proceed in this, I have as an organizational unit, which presents, which could be the geographical location or geographical structure in the in this organizational unit. However, I'm going to be using my location. York, excuse me. Again, I'll also be adding apartment in here, New York. Excuse me. All these IT. So under this IT, like I did earlier with the New York, there is a check mark here that says protect container from accidental deletion. So with this as a check mark, it will protect this organizational unit, you know, for any accidental deletion. In this case, as you can see here, is my lab.bin and in New York. So I have to proceed on this. Okay. So I have created the department and I'll also continue from there and create the users. In this place, in this volume, I still want to use another another method in creating this organizational unit within this IT. So as you can see up here, you can see the users. You can create users from here. You can also create groups, and you can also create organizational units in this column. So now it's still on the IT. I will be using the same column to create PGIP. I'm going to use PGIP. GIP talk. So let me be strong. Just give me
Benjamin, are you talking? Because we can't hear you.
No, I don't think he's, I think okay. I've heard him mumbling okay. a couple of times. I think
I
he's
heard
just trying
something
to,
too.
Yeah, he's kind of just mumbling to himself while he's trying to figure out. He's doing what I did basically, but he gets quiet. I start yelling at things, but I was trying not to cuss in front of, you know, that's the one we have, Dr. Burton here. Very much a like, maybe a stupid question, Benjamin, but are you logged in under like the admin account in order to actually access the privileges for this?
Yes. Oh. I have to continue using it and see what is going to be the outcome in doing this. This is the user that I am to assign other users in this group. So here, let me proceed and add in users. This department here, I will use so one to populate here, and I will add the user logon name. Let me say as you can see here, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yep, so you're good.
On the user logon name, I added a PGIP tech user one at mylab.bin. And as you can see on the user logon name, pre-window installed 2000, it's PGIP one. So let's proceed. So add the password. Shows here that mylab.bin, New York IT, PGIP Tech. So here is just to show the informations which I have already filled in the first column. So this is a full name, PGIP Tech user one, and user logon name and the rest with the password. So let's click on finish. We have added one user in this group. So let's continue and add another user in this place. So I'm going to use two users in this regard. So let's click on here. Continue and add. Excuse me. You can continue. click on continue. Finish. So here we have finally created two users. So we are going to continue to from here and create a group inside this pulley. So the group we are going to create is under this is have to use another second method on creating the group. So let's call this group name in this object. GIP. So here, you can see we have a group name PGIP underscore user. The group name with the pre, it came with the group name pre window 2000 with this. So under the group, under the global group scope and the globe and the security group type. So we don't need to do anything from here. Just click OK. Here we can see this is the group that we have just created, and this is the security group type and the global group scope. So if we want to make changes in here, put S to make a kind of correction and hit enter. It's going to be, you know, showing us based on trying to rename this group. This is a PGIP tech user. I need to make that correction here to put that S to click OK. That's OK. So now, what we are going to do in this demonstration is to add these two users, these two user one and user two in this group, in this place. So what we're gonna do is go ahead and add these members. This members to group. Let's use the properties. Here, my domain user is mylab.bin/user. So add. Yeah. So this the list of Active Directory domains you can, you know, you can use this place to add most of the Active Directory if you really, you know, what depends what you want to use it for. So, but for the purpose of this demonstration, I'm using the PGIP tech user to add them to this group. So let's go ahead and click OK. So I have, as you can see, it has been added here. So click apply and click OK. So the second one is to add the VGIP user 2 tag to this group. Add this using the column advance. And add VGIP tag. It's been added to this group. So check. Index the VGIP user 1 and the VGIP tag user 2 in this VGIP tag users as members. Okay. So from here we have added the users. We have added the groups in this, we have added the member of the groups in this demonstration. So this is how you can add or create organizational units, users, and groups in Windows Server 2019 Active Directory. So I tried to see if I can delete this initially, but I couldn't. Let me just go back and see if really I can be able to make some deletion in just in case if it requires for any deletion. So just give me a little bit time. Thank you. Right. So I don't want to be taking much of your time and my own. I'm really sorry that I don't really know what is happening with my machine right now. So I will take a leave. Thank you very much.
Oh, good job, Benjamin. I'm sure you'll figure it out. Don't stay up too late trying to figure it out, though. Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Oops, double muted. Sorry about that. Not particularly. I'm just kind of curious because I do the exact same thing, trying to figure out why things don't work. When you try to delete that, it does say that it's either you don't have permissions or it's protected. Is the little, like, if you look at the icon on that particular folder that you're trying to delete, it's kind of smaller, little, like, it looks like a lock on it. Is it set to be, like, delete proof for some reason in the properties or anything like that either? Like, if you were to right-click on it and check the properties, would it have a way to, like, prevent this from being, you know, deleted?
I have tried this several times before.
And it works fine.
I come here, it works fine. So
yeah, that's the same thing with me.
I am starting a fresh demonstration in this. I've been deleting it and I've been doing everything and this.
Saw mine, man. Did the exact same thing. I know how it goes. Okay. So I was just curious.
So I just don't know.
No, completely understandable. Like I said, I bought mine too, just because like. You check it before you're like, okay, am I set? Like, I even had it like, okay, I want my screen to be split so I can show one side and actually like show where the program is and what it says. And then this is kind of what happens with it. And I was so set up and then I got into it and it was just like, we're not going to work right now because you're in front of everybody. And that's kind of how that works. So don't even worry about it, man.
Did you run it as administrator when you opened the program?
Yes, I run it as administrator.
Okay.
As you can see from, hold on, let me show you something. So, as you can see from here,
and you're running us off of a VM box as well, so it might be giving you trouble just because it's running off a virtual box for whatever reason.
You can see this, I run it as administrator, so
well,
I log in here as administrator.
So. That's actually an interesting concept, though. I don't know. I haven't really worked with Active Directory enough, but even being logged in as administrator, sometimes you're not kind of enforcing administrator level privileges until you actually right click it and tell it to run as administrator so that it's not actually giving too many permissions to people. So being logged in as admin and actually using your admin level privileges sometimes don't actually act the same thing.
Yeah, but this
if you're saying it's worked before, yeah,
to you know make some deletion regards to this, but you know it keeps on. I don't know what's really
right happening. Yeah, no, we'll figure it out, or you'll figure it out, I'm sure. Give some time, and a lot of times with IT especially, it's one of those hit the head on the table like that was the stupidest fix that really shouldn't have been an issue, but for some reason it was. So I'm sure you'll get there.
Thank you.
I love
my
your
favorite
Homer
saying
Simpson
is
meme.
It's always something.
Yeah, I like the Homer Simpson too. Well, thank you everyone for participating and those that contributed tonight. And I'm sure everyone is ready to move on. I don't know about you guys, but I am exhausted.
Yeah, 2 hours of masterclass will do that.
But it was awesome.
It was
awesome,
really
though.
Great. Sorry, Tim. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, every single one of them was great, though, for different reasons. But I've been here and just really listening. And your persistence, all of you that are trying to figure out your stuff, is just awesome.
I feel personally attacked.
No, I would have said, okay, next.
I almost did.
No, not in that way. Next, I would have said, I don't care anymore. I'm going to do something else now. You're like, want to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah, I thought about doing a live demonstration and then decided, no.
And aren't you glad that you did?
not going to go that route. Sorry.
My decision was based upon the fact that I'm terrible at PowerPoint presentations, and I'm more comfortable just being like, hey, here's what I'm trying to say. Let me just show you. and then things did not want to cooperate.
That was all good.
It's not bad when it works out.
All right, everyone.
Oh, by the way, while I have you here, Miss Hatton, I did notice that you slipped into the Discord the other day.
I did. My class told me last night. They're like, does this class have a Discord channel?
Nope, the entire faculty and, you know, student body have one. Well, at least right now it's more that one is IT focused, but
yeah. All right, everybody. I'm gonna say goodnight and we'll be stopping the recording. Have a great night. Have a great weekend. Remember to defrag.
Yep, and let's hit the last meetings Monday and Tuesday with a bang. Let's do them hard because it's going to be a tearjerker, I hope.
All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
That all.
Thank you.
Good night.